Hello everybody, it's Jughead, and I'm going to make this one very short. As of recently, since the pandemic is hopefully nearing its end, which is a great thing, one of the effects has been that it has been more difficult to get guests on the show because everyone wants to be back out playing live. And also, viewership has dropped drastically in the last couple weeks. Not quite sure why, but I think it probably has something to do with that. So the only selling of my wares I'll do today is the Patreon, of course, www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com. Go there and become a patron at the $2, $5, and $10 levels and get, you know, unedited videos of the podcast released to you before the at-home audience gets them. The other thing I will say as regard to how I open this is that I could really, really, really use your help. If you are a fan of this podcast, it is dire in these days to share it with other people. Share it with your family or fish or dinosaurs back in the Paleolithic days, or anybody that values your opinion or doesn't value your opinion. Tell them not to listen to it and maybe they will. But I really could use your help. And that's what I'm pushing this week. Share it with others. Talk about it at the bar. Go back deep into the archives and pull out some of the album dissections. So there's that. And thank you very much, everyone. I love the fact that people are listening to the show. And I've been doing it for 10 years now. And the last couple years have been very exciting. A lot of great interviews. Speaking of which, you may or may not heard of Danny Dunlap and his band The Gentlemen Rogues, but I've recently discovered them. I think he is a great musician, probably underrated for right now, but I think his new material will definitely be sweet candy for your ears. So give this interview a listen and then go out and purchase some of his material. Here we go. Right now, you're listening to Do the Resurrection by The Gentlemen Rogues, released in 2020. Hello, and welcome to Jughead's Basement, episode 121 of Lo-Fi Interviews with Hi-Fi Guests. This week, starring Danny Dunlap of The Gentlemen Rogues, also bands The Fall Collection and Jill. This week, we talk about such things as Houston, Texas, and the Axiom venue. Is Danny a failure? His first band, Jill. Songwriting compared to novel writing. His second band, The Fall Collection. And his debilitating days of arthritis. The brilliance of Erasure's Vince Clark. Opening for Bob Mould. And much, much more Dunlap more.
So this podcast has no video. You don't put this on YouTube or anything?
I just for the patrons, there's like 20 or 30 people. So if you're okay with that, it will go to them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well,
if I would have known that, I wouldn't have cut myself shaving yesterday. So
well, I'm always cutting myself shaving. And my whole neck
I mean, people are always like, is your neck all right? Which I hate shaving.
Your neck okay?
Danny, thanks. It's nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you.
I'm always working on how to frame these interviews because these are long form ones, so I don't like just focusing just on the band. And I didn't know anything about you, but the framing for me, Danny, is going to be how that someone's been in the business for 30 years through punk, pop punk into a couple different bands. You've been at it straight through and I've never met you.
Yeah. But I bet that we have a lot of mutual friends. I don't have an answer for that. I mean, other than I'm a failure. I mean, that's my only answer off the top of my head. It's like, I've been doing it for a long time, but I haven't been, I guess, consistent with it. And maybe that's the difference. I did bands for a long time when I was younger and then years off and kind of didn't play music for a while. So that might be, why my involvement is sort of like sporadic. I don't know. Hmm. I don't know what the word for it would be.
Now I'm interested in you saying, I know you're joking, partly joking, but also you have to look at a career I've been around for 30 years. And I got to say to you, Danny, it's not musically. Your music is really great. I really like it. It's
Oh, thanks.
It's it toys with like being slightly derivative and then you depart into your own world on each stuff. I really like that. I like your use of like dipping into other mainstream songs and then taking what you like from it and making your own work.
Mm.
So I think what you're doing is I really enjoy it. So, but I just want to dig into this, this full life in music. And then you said you went in and out of it. So of course, and I'm the same way too. I've been cursed with being in bands that don't tour as much. So luckily I was in a band that did pretty well, but it's been hard ever since. Cause if you don't tour, you don't get your face out there. It's just harder to get your music sold. Let's walk through it. You started in San Angelo, which is where you grew up, where you were born in Houston, which I have a soft spot for because one of my favorite venues was in there called the Axiom.
Yeah. I mean, I was too young to know that, but I've gone back to Houston, tons and tons of times throughout my life. And I'm familiar with that club. I have to ask you this. You're pulling some Nardwar stuff on. How did you know I was born in Houston?
I do my studying.
It's just weird because I only lived there till I was like 4 years old.
Four years old, yes.
4 or 5 years old, yeah.
Well, it stuck with me because I have like an affinity. I fell in love with a girl in Houston and even made it into my book. And so I often think very fondly of Houston. Also, I thought Houston in the days, like in the mid 80s, there wasn't any designated music scene. So everybody went to everything, which I think is a great breeding ground for like interesting music to come through because no one has those blinders on as to what they're supposed to sound like. So I thought the Axiom sort of embodied that, the East Side, it was dangerous around there. There was like wild dogs on the streets.
Was that in like the Westheimer area? Is that correct?
Yeah, maybe. I am not really good at that. I just looked online and it said that like the East Village or the East part of the city.
Gotcha.
And I remember when we got out of our van, there actually was wild dogs that roamed around there.
That's funny.
Promoter said that people would just get rid of their dogs and they would pack up.
And they would all rally to the Axiom.
And hang out with the punks.
I know the venue, but I might be mixing up the location a little bit. But yeah, I know that place.
This is John in the future. And of course, I went to the Google to find out information about this. The Axiom in Houston, Texas is a defunct music venue. The former liquor warehouse at 2524 McKinney, just east of Dowling, wasn't much to look at, inside or out. But from 1987 to 1992, it was the home base of a thriving music scene encompassing rock, punk, funk, metal, hardcore, thrash, industrial, psychedelia, and a few styles people still haven't figured out how to label. Back to Danny and me.
So you were in the band called Jill.
Yeah.
Is that your first, your band? First band?
That was the first kind of like, the first band that we did original music where I started writing songs. I was in a band when I was in high school called the Nocturnal Pigeon Boys. And And we were kind of like a cover band. We were all friends who didn't know how to play our instruments very well. Well, actually, some of us did. And I was just the singer in that band. And we would do like Descendants covers and The Clash and just stuff like that. And that was kind of like my introduction to like being in a band. But Jill was the first band where my friend Matt and I, we bought instruments, literally were like, let's start a band. We should do that. And we're like, what do you want to play? And he's like, I always wanted to play drums and I always want to play guitar. So we went to bought some stuff. And the next day we were like, we had started a band, but we had no idea how to play. So that was kind of like the beginning of it. And we were a band for probably about 5 or 6 years. And
yeah, I think I said 93 to 97.
Probably started more in like 92. But yeah, we eventually learned how to play instruments and started writing our own songs and did that band for a long time. So toured a bunch and that was kind of my sort of intro into sort of writing my own songs and kind of playing in a, you know, kind of poppy punk band.
Yeah. I can't remember, you know, touring through Texas is like touring through a whole country. You know, it's not, you know, it's,
yeah.
You know, people could say, oh, you're probably bi. It's like, no, that's like 10 hours away from.
Yeah, I've never tried it, but I've heard that it takes 24 hours to drive from one side of Texas to the other. So,
yeah, I just remember we would have these at the beginning of the band. We booked our own tours with Weasel, and, you know, you can never get the dream is to get venues right in a row, you know, so you're always going the same direction. But when you're a beginning band, you can't do that. So you. In Texas was hellacious because you'd play one venue and then pass it on your way to the next venue, like 6 hours in the other direction and then back again. So this is leading to a question, Danny, which is, did you have shows, like local shows there? Did you have to put on your own like basement shows and stuff?
We did. We did DIY shows there. San Angelo in Texas kind of in general doesn't really have basements in the homes, but we did some interesting shows. We initially started booking conference rooms at like hotels, like La Quinta Inn. I don't know if you know what La Quinta is.
Yeah, I do. I stay there often.
We would we would book the conference rooms and we would put on shows there. We did that a couple of times. And then we eventually found this barn that was in the backyard of some people's house. And we would throw shows in this barn in the back of this like field. And then when that kind of stopped happening, we started doing shows at this place we called The Room, which was our rehearsal space, but it was like a kind of a vacated little office building that had maybe like three rooms in it. We gutted the kind of mid-level wall out of the lobby. And we had this sort of big room that could hold about 50 people. And we would do like DIY punk shows and stuff in there. And then the office that had the door with the lock on it, that's where we would rehearse on days we weren't doing shows.
Yeah, that's a nice little setup. But I mean, that's actually a pretty golden period in like the pop punk scene too. Were you able to get bands that were like starting out during that time into your little area?
Yeah, we had a lot of actually really good shows. I mean, including dating back to the barn, we had Jimmy Eat World. They were kind of like went on to be a very popular band. When they were first starting out, we did some shows for them in San Angelo. The first time they ever went on tour, we did a show for them at my friend, RJ, our bass player, his mom's living room. And they played, you know, for like 50 people crammed in this living room. But it was so fun that when they came back, they would be like, oh, we're going to come through Texas again. And we kind of become friends with them. And so we're like, yeah, let's do another show. And they did one out in the barn and they did one at The Room, and Squirt Gun, Lookout Records band came through. I remember those guys came through and played a show at The Room. But yeah, there was a lot of bands, and I lived it with my mom and my dad. I was 19 or 20 when we started doing all that stuff. And so I had my own bedroom. Of course, I didn't sleep in the bedroom with my parents. And I had my own separate, phone. And so I would like, that was like, I would just get random calls from bands that they'd leave, you know, voicemails on my answering machine and be like, oh, our band's coming through. And I would just be this 19-year-old kid, like booking all these bands.
Were you part of the MRR, like book your own fucking life sort of circuit?
We were, I think maybe we're in there. I can't remember, but we definitely used that when Jill would book tours, because we were pretty much like 100% DIY. We had like a really small record label called Springbox Records that was putting out our stuff, and they were based out of Benicia, California. You know, we didn't have like a booking agent or any of that stuff. We just did all that ourselves.
You did get around the is that probably the one out of the three you probably got around more in the like touring wise? Or I know with Gentlemen Rogues, you said you have done some European tours here and there, but it sounds like to me, like in the earlier days of Jill, there was probably a lot more just get on the road and do it type of, I mean, you know, we're younger, so we're more able to do that.
Yeah, we were definitely pretty gung-ho about it. I think we would go out for, I think we did about maybe seven tours with Jill over the course of like 3 or 4 years. Yeah, we would just book these tours, go out for like a month or go out for 2 or 3 weeks and then come home for a few months and then just do it again. So it was kind of interesting to, you know, this was all pre-internet and stuff too. So it lots of phone calls and expensive bills, and some cases you'd book shows like people would be like, write a letter. You're sending letters to people to book shows. I mean, that was so strange. Send a demo tape and a letter, and you know, it's just crazy how
I remember me and Ben used to I used to book the tours, but he used to like set the pattern, and it was all handwritten stuff. Like he would either hand it to me or mail me, because he lived farther away, and and I'd have to call all these venues. And my thing was, I would always complain about is you'd come home from a tour where you lost money, and then like a month later, you get like a $2,000 phone bill. You know, you're like, could it get any worse?
Yeah, it's totally true. I know. You're like, I owe, you know, $300 in what I lost on tour, and I have like this $500 phone bill from booking the stupid thing. But it was worth it. You know, it was always like, I've never been a person to like do music because I wanted to make money or wanted to get rich and famous or whatever. So you just do it because you love it, and you lose money all the time, and you just keep doing it happily.
That leads me to a question then that might come up later in the context of the other bands. I've noticed like me and Ben were forced into positions where we had to become our own lawyer, our own accountant, you know, it's the kind of punk way you sort of learn all this stuff. Did you take on any of the hats? Were you like the main hat guy?
Like in what kind of hats?
What kind of hats? I would say now I'm moving away from music, more like business wise. Did you have to like keep the finances, and did you like decide when you guys were going to go?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, we would kind of collectively do that stuff. And usually I would kind of book all of our tours, and we would kind of get together and map out like when we were going to go, where we were going to go. And we would kind of, you know, literally pull out like a, you know, road atlas or whatever and kind of map, you know, draw lines around where you're going to go. And then just start booking it. And I think that I probably booked the majority of the tours myself. And then we would, you know, just kind of like we had a little per diem. We'd try that whole thing because we'd read other bands did that, you know. Mm-hmm. Everyone gets $5 a day to eat a Taco Bell burrito.
And, oh, I know that.
You know, that kind of thing. So we would sort of, I guess I sort of was managing the band too, if you call that managing a band. road manager. / singer guitarist / booking agent, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, have you ever had like, does your band even now have management, or do you still pretty much do all the work yourselves? I know now you hired Chris to work with you, which is more of a PR person, but have you done most of your business yourself over the years?
Yeah, I mean, we don't have a manager, we don't have a booking agent. We do have a label. We work with labels. We're not like signed, you know.
We
work with a label called Shifting Sounds that's a local Austin label. They put out some of our first EP and like a 7-inch single, and we worked with another label called In Sounds, which is another local Austin label who put out a EP called A History So Repeating. And then now we've been working with Chuck Coffey at Snappy Little Numbers. He's in a really cool punk band called Spells.
In editing, I realized that Danny cut out a little bit here, so I will say that he's talking about a man named Chuck Coffey, Coffey, and the band is called Spells, Spells.
He's put out our last two singles, and then we have a 12-inch thing that's coming out in the next couple of months that's put out by Snappy Little Numbers and Rocket Heart Records out of Washington.
Right. It's the like a combination of two of your EPs, right? A digital EP. And then, yeah.
Exactly. It's a History So Repeating from In Sounds and then an EP called Fatal Music. And it's like one EP on each side. So neither one of those have existed on vinyl. So we're super, and always, we always wanted them to. So we're really excited to finally get that out on wax.
In my studying, I noticed that Snappy Little Numbers also have as a place where you can rent a DJ.
Yeah. That's Chuck.
He's his own DJ. Yeah,
he's an entrepreneur.
Wow, that's how I started. I started out with a DJ company called Out of Control, which is kind of a funny name for a DJ company. We would do weddings. And then it turned into actually the venue. McGregor's, my friend who ran the DJ company with me, started McGregor's, which is the place where like Green Day came to Chicago for the first time.
I've seen YouTube videos of shows from that place. Is it Elmhurst?
Yeah, that came from my DJ company.
Oh, cool. Yeah, it's interesting. It has like that stage with like the rails on the front. You know, that's...
Yeah, it was kind of a crazy place.
Yeah, it looks like it. That's awesome.
Were you, Danny, pursuing... You were living at home for the beginning of Jill. Were you living at home all the time through then moving to Austin? Or you did... Because you didn't move to Austin until like 2000, I think, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I've lived here for a little over 20 years. I lived outside of my parents' house for a little while before I moved to Austin, but I did probably stay there longer than I should have and needed to or whatever. But yeah, I was just like, San Angelo, Texas is about 3.5 hours west of here. And it's just kind of a smaller place, especially back then. It's like maybe 100,000 people. It's 4 or 5 years behind in sort of mentality and, you know, whatever's hip or whatever. But yeah, I lived there until I was about 23 or 24. And then I quit playing music. This kind of goes back to what I was saying at the beginning, where I'm like, I'm done with music. I'm tired of it. I'm tired of being in a band. And I left and moved to go to college. So I went to school in San Marcos, Texas, which is about 40 minutes down the road from Austin. And I got a degree in graphic design. And probably like my last couple of semesters of college, I was just like, I want to be in a band again. Like, and I never really quit playing music. Like I bought a drum set when I moved. And even though I never played drums, I just kind of always wanted to. And so I had that set up in my living room and I just played drums every day. And my guitars were all like under my bed. I didn't touch them for like a year. And all I did was play drums and go to school.
Do you think that helped your sense of rhythm in ways? Like in ways that you can tangibly, once you went back to guitar, did you feel like that changed you at all? I know for me, even in Blackouts, it did. I purposely didn't like my rhythm. I relied on the drums too much. So I started a band that didn't have a drummer at first. And it actually did build up my ability to play rhythm better.
I don't know. I don't know if it helped me play rhythm better necessarily, but what it did do is I feel like during that period of time, the ideas for songs became more elaborate or something. Like when I would write songs, I would start hearing what all the other instruments would do, you know, whereas maybe before I would only kind of think about the guitar and I'd only think about the singing and the lyrics and the guitar. And I would never really think about like, what should the drums play or what should the bass line do? And I feel like when I started learning other instruments, when I wrote songs, I could kind of hear the whole song as I was writing it and kind of had more of a vision for it. I think that's what it helped me do, is see like a bigger vision for a song.
Oh yeah. That's interesting. I can relate that with writing, because I started out as a playwright and then I tried to move into novel writing and I realized I had to learn a new thing, because it couldn't just be just dialogue. Well, it could, you can do anything in a novel, but yeah. I had to learn how to describe the things around with that. And then once you get that caught in that, and then you're like, what don't I describe? You know, you get caught in this like world of like, what do you use and what don't you use?
I couldn't imagine writing like a novel, because I dread writing like lyrics to songs. Yeah. Because I'm just like, I feel like I can get a song and I can write the music to it, you know, fairly quickly, but then I'll sit and I'll procrastinate like just insanely, because I'm afraid I'm going to ruin the song by putting like really shitty lyrics on it. and so I won't write it, you know. I'll just kind of be like, oh, I'll get around to it, or I'll do it tomorrow, and you know, I'll do that for months, and then I'll finally have to forced to do it at some point because we're going to go record or whatever. And then in the end, I'm usually pretty happy with the way they turn out, but I just dread writing it. So that's just, you know, a couple of verses and a chorus that you see three times but writing a novel, you know, is like, that would terrify me.
It is probably the most painful loved thing that I've done. I've done it twice and I'm on my third and it's so hard.
How long does it take you to do it?
My first one, which was based on like the touring of Screeching Weasel, but I would still call like a surreal fiction novel, took me 7 years. That one took 7 years.
Wow.
And my second one took 3 years, but then it was based on the movie It's a Wonderful Life. So I actually took a year to fix any, study the movie, study the book it was based on. And I had to tinker and change, you know, names of things and elaborate just so, you know, super fans of the movie wouldn't come to my door knocking, you got this wrong.
That's funny. So 7 years on the first one and then 3 years on the second.
Yeah, I would say 4 year once the editing, because the first one I edited myself. The second one, I actually took that step of hiring a creative editor, which where you work with them, you know, on
watching
stuff. So I would add another year onto that. So four.
That's about how long it takes me to write lyrics to one song, 4 years.
Now, I've heard you say, because this is always an interesting thing to me too, because I mean, as a creator, and I think growing up with albums too, there is the ultimate goal is to do albums. And I understand that sometimes that isn't the goal for some people. And I heard in an interview where you were talking about like EPs was your thing. Like it kind of made sense for you. Was that, did that have something to do with like, I want to call you like a meticulous, but did it scare you to go beyond that smaller package of what you could achieve and call it your own perfection? Does that make any sense?
No, it actually absolutely does. It makes too much sense. In fact, I think you're right. I mean, I think even if it was subconscious, it was probably me convincing myself that like EPs are better because there are these short little blasts, you know, you get 5 or 6 songs, 4 to 6, and then it's over. And that's cool because people's attention spans are short. And I probably justified a lot of it in my own head. But if I really think about it, I probably was on some level kind of like overwhelmed. The idea of doing more than that, you know what I mean? Like making a full album or something.
Do you consider, I know this is an interesting question. Oh, I've never asked this before, that a song in itself to me is an art project. You know, it's, you know, whether you're a painter or a sculptor or a musician, the song is the art. Do you consider the package to be an extension of that? Like does everything interconnect for you?
The package meaning like the artwork that goes along with the song.
I'm extending it to the whole realm, but I mean, my first thought was the songs in themselves, but then the songs in themselves become the package, you know,
like the collection of songs.
Yeah.
I mean, for sure, because I mean, if I'm following what you're asking, there, what I think is important is a kind of like a continuity between the package, you know, like. You can have one really great song and you can have, you know, 7 or 8 really great songs or 20, but if they don't all sound like they fit together, I think you kind of have a problem at that point. You know, you don't want your album on like a mixtape of of different bands or of like a compilation CD, but it's actually all the same band. I feel like everything should be compact and have like continuity between it. So it all, you know, fits together and flows. And
I think, Danny, I think I have sensitivity to that for a couple of different reasons, because being an 80s child, you know, everyone talked about one hit wonders. And then being a sort of a record collector, I would dig in and like, you know, the Vapors, they have Turning Japanese, but that whole record is amazing.
That's great.
So there's this, I don't know, a worry of me of becoming like not a one hit wonder, but that your whole career becomes like a single or something. So, but then I'm also thinking of when we started, Screeching Weasel started, there was a rebellion against other music I liked, like Jethro Tull, which was like concept records. You know, for some reason, punks were rebelling against that idea. And then luckily, me and Ben talked about this stuff and it became, that how could it not be a concept? You're dealing with songs within a certain amount of time of your life that you're thinking about. So let's play with this concept idea, but not make it like a whole other world where you're going into, you know, and then it has like one story. So I guess I'm very sensitive to talking about a band's choice or a musician's choice like you, Danny, to how you decide to package your music. And I'm also really into, I'm sorry, I'm talking a lot, Danny, because
No, you're fine.
I've been in my house alone all day. But I just talked to Chris from Crazy in the Brains, and they do basically song and then a video. And that's more of a, it seems like a, he's a younger guy than us. So it's like a younger man's game that they acquaint the video with that song. Is like he says, when he writes a song, he sees the video. It's like one and the same.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting.
So I was wondering whether that, because your new song, which I think is great, was it called? Not France.
Francie.
Yeah, Francie. Great song. A cool video, thanks, too. Like it looks like everyone's in front of different amps, but you're all in front of that same section of amps, right?
Hey, you know what? You picked up on something. You know what? This was our level of detail is that we would film one person playing to the song a few times, and then we would all grab amps and rearrange these massive wall of amps. We rearranged them so that when we did the next person, it didn't look like the exact same backdrop or whatever.
Yeah,
that's funny that you noticed that. I'm actually glad you noticed it because we all had sore backs at the end of the day from doing that like three or four different times.
Yeah, and I really like the shadow work on there too. I just love filming the shadows too. That's a cool idea with that video.
That was a happy accident on that because our friend Daniel, who was filming it, he and I went up the night before we did the shoot that next day, and we set all those amps up, and he brought this spotlight, and he's like, yeah, I'm going to use this spotlight and we're just going to do that on the amps. So I initially was like, oh, that seems really lame. And then we saw what it looked like, and it was just like, oh shit, that's awesome. And then when we started filming stuff, I was kind of sitting back watching someone else do their, you know, play like they're rocking out or whatever. And I started just watching the shadow the whole time. And that was an idea that came the day of the shoot, which was like, the shadows look so cool. Why don't we do takes where that's all we film is the shadow of the person and don't even try to get their body in it at all. And that's some of my favorite stuff in the video is the actual shadow.
The song Francie will be at the end of this podcast, but you can also find the video at the www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com website at the Lo-Fi Interviews section. You could also just search YouTube, but please go to my website.
So I guess my question, Danny, was that a natural progression for you? Like, is it natural for you for music to become visual, to like a video, like to me, I'm resistant to it, but they're for no good reason. Yeah. For no good reason.
Oh, you know what, man? I was never consciously resistant to it. The short answer is no. It's not visual to me at all, and it never has been up until recently. And I'll tell you what changed it was. I hate to say this, but it was COVID, because when we did our last single, which was called "Do the Resurrection," that was like we recorded that single and that B-side, which I think is what you were referring to earlier, where we merge that Lemonhead song and the Super Drag song, and we make kind of a new song out of, it's like a weird hybrid cover song. We recorded that, and then like COVID and everything hit like a month later, maybe. So we had just finished this single, and we kind of go, well, you know, everyone had to go home from work and no one can leave their house for a couple of weeks. And, you know, fast forward 2.5 years later, we're still sort of dealing with it. But at the time it was like, well, you know, this is going to be like this for a little bit. And then it got to where it got longer and longer. So then when we started doing the single, I just kind of one Saturday night, I was sitting around at the house and I just started emailing it out to labels. And within like 48 hours, I think we had three labels that were like, hey, this is great, we'll put this out. And so we're like, oh shit. Like, cause I was like, what are we going to do with this thing? We're just kind of sit here forever. And we just recorded it. We spent money on it.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah. And so we really quickly found some labels to put it out, but because we couldn't play shows and we couldn't do blah, 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 we said, well, why don't we try some stuff we've never done before, which is make a video. So that was one of the things we did with Direction was we made a video, and we hired a, a P PR person. That's something we'd never done before. And just, it was just one of those things like, what we can't play, we can't tour. Let's just try to do some weird stuff we've never done before. And it actually worked out really good for us. Seemed like people liked the song and liked the video, and it got on Little Steven's Underground Garage. It was like in the world. And so it just went over really well. So when we did the new single, we just were like, let's just take the same plan of attack since COVID is still kind of a thing. I think when we did Francie, like Delta was sort of going on when we recorded that song. And we were just like, let's do another 7-inch with Chuck. We'll put it out. We'll make a video. We'll hire a PR person. We'll just do all this again. And so that's kind of where we're at. That's why you and I are talking, you know? So I guess the answer is, it's like, it's not a visual thing for me, but we've gotten interested in the visual thing because it was sort of in a weird way, kind of not out of necessity, but just out of like venturing to do something different.
And that does lead into my next question, which is, I wouldn't say guilty of this. It's just part of me that someone recently had asked why I kept theater and music separate. And there was something cool about being in theater and them not knowing that I was in a semi-famous band. There's something cool about that. But also, yeah, there was just something in my brain that kept it separate. So, and I think you said you studied graphic art, right? So
yeah, graphic design.
So you are a visual person. Was there something in your brain that kept the music and that separate for so long for you?
Josh, who plays drums in Gentleman Rogues, he and I were in a band called The Fall Collection before this. And Josh does design as well. So there hasn't ever really been a big separation, because in The Fall Collection and in Gentleman Rogues, we tend to do a lot of our own like artwork and design, and a lot of the ideas that we have for like the cover art and all that stuff is our own. So we're very involved in like the visual aspect of the band.
And did you make a career in graphic art?
Not at all. I graduated college, and like the last, like I said, the last two semesters, I was like itching to start a band. And I went to school full time. I worked full time for 5 years, 40 hour work weeks, and, you know, 4 classes a semester. And I did that for 4 or 5 years. So when I got done with college, man, I was like, what? I have free time. I can start a band. I can like sleep in. I can, you know, do all these things I haven't been able to do for 5 years. So we started The Fall Collection around the last semester or two of my college. And then we did that band for, I don't know, maybe 4 years or something. Did some touring and put out an EP, and just did that band for a while. So that's kind of that. And I've kind of been doing music somewhat consistently since then, somewhat. Little breaks here and there.
I think we were leading to something I wanted to touch on, which is the continuing member for you. Is Josh on drums. And you started this, the Gentleman Rogues. At first, there was a different drummer, Matt, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Matty B, Matt Bollock.
Yes. But I'm always interested in those relationships that go on for now. You've probably been working with Josh for, 12, 13 years?
Yeah, probably so. We did The Fall Collection for about 4 years. And then he's been in Gentleman Rogues way longer than he hasn't been. He was not the original drummer, but the original drummer, Matt, was only in the band for maybe the first like 2 years. And then he left. And then I asked Josh if he was interested, and he came in, and here we are. We're still going.
What was the reason behind the breaking up of The Fall Collection? And then not immediately going into another band with Josh? I mean, that's just interesting to me. And it's probably something very simple, but
it's actually not that simple. It's I'll explain it. It kind of goes back to being a failure. It felt like The Fall Collection, like we were just not really getting anywhere. And in Austin, it was like, you know, during that period, what was really popular kind of commercially and locally was bands like Interpol, lots of like Skinny Ties and sort of Joy Division, New Order, like revivalist kind of stuff. You know, we were like a power poppy band that was like influenced by The Jam and Ted Leo and The Pharmacists. And that was kind of stuff that we were into and kind of were playing stuff in that degree. And that just wasn't, you know, despite our name, The Fall Collection, it was not fashionable to be in a band like that. And so, you know, we did it because we like doing it, and we like we made, and we toured some, and we put out some music, you know, to the public and stuff, but it felt like we were just kind of like not getting anywhere. I started having some health problems. I have psoriatic arthritis. The time in the fall collection, I didn't know I had that. I just, my body was just kind of like falling apart.
Oh man.
I felt like I was like 90 years old and my body just hurt all the time. And I never understood like what was going on with me. The band was frustrating because it was like, we're a good band. We knew we were a good band, but we just seemed like we could never find our place anywhere. And that was really frustrating. And then on top of that, it was like, we were working hard to do this band and it became physically kind of painful to like do the band.
Oh,
and,
man. Yeah.
You know, just loading out gear out of the van was just like, it was just miserable. So I think my brain just went, fuck this, you know, like I need to get away from this for a while and figure out what the hell's wrong with me. And we broke the band up and then play music for maybe like a year and a half after that at all.
Oh, you didn't at all. So there's like a year and a half between those two bands, huh?
Yeah, about a year and a half. And Maddie B was the original drummer at Gentleman Robes, and he worked at a coffee shop that I would go to on my way to work. And I'd figured out what was wrong with me. I figured out I had psoriatic arthritis. I started treating it, and then I got better and started functioning like a human, or at least someone my age. Mm-hmm. I could walk and without limping, and my body didn't hurt anymore. And
oh man,
yeah, it was weird. But that went on for like a year and a half. I can't move. I can't get out of bed. It was just weird. But once I figured it out, I started treating it and I got better. And then once I got normal again, I was like, oh, I want to start playing music again now that I can do that. So then Matt and I just would talk all the time when I would get coffee on the way to work and learn that we liked a lot of the same stuff. And he was a drummer and I was like, oh, we should get together and play. And we did. And that's sort of how we started the band. It was just me and him for a few months. And we just kind of slowly started finding people to fill the roles, asking friends and stuff. Once, oh, this is going to work, this will be cool, we started filling, and we became, you know, officially a band.
So once Matt left, it made perfect sense to bring Josh, because you had still been in contact with Josh on some level?
Yeah, some level, not as much. I think I had a lot of guilt for like breaking up. I always think nobody likes me, and I'm like real,
oh, man.
I have like weird problems in my brain that tell me nobody likes me. And so I was just kind of like, he's mad at me, he hates me, he, you know, and so I kept in touch with him, but maybe like not as much as I could have and should have, because I think I felt guilty and that he like, I felt like he resented me, even though he probably didn't at all, you know.
But ultimately, he must like your music. Did he say yes pretty quickly, pretty easily?
I had to wine and dine him a little bit. We went out to, yeah, I took him out for some margaritas and some enchiladas or something. And we talked about it. And he said, let me think about it. And I was like, all right. And then I think maybe a couple of days later, he was like, yeah, let's give it a try. And so here we are.
Oh, great, great, great. Yeah,
I felt like he played hard to get a little bit.
I'm not really good at paying attention to drummers, but there, you got a strong foundation there, a strong like rhythm section going on in those songs. It's pretty good.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, he's great.
I'm going to do a step out thing where I don't know what this will lead to, but let's see. But I was thinking about this today while I was cleaning and listening to your music, that often there's people that, like, I knew from the art world, I studied the art world, you know, like the impressionists didn't actually call themselves the impressionists. It's other critics that come in and start naming a movement or something. But so this kind of statements comes from that sort of place, where having listened to all three of your bands, at least that have recorded, it seemed like the pop punk band really gave into that pop punk of the day, the Green Day, had that feel. And then Fall Collection seemed, even though you say it was more poppy, I think gave in a little bit to that Interpol and stuff, where it was a little less melodic based and a little bit more experimental, I would think, than probably Jill.
Yeah, oh yeah, definitely different from Jill. I would say the Fall Collection, like we were, I would call us maybe more of like an indie rock band that had some kind of like punky influences, because we definitely were like really trying to kind of pull from like the Jam and the Buzzcocks. But we also were kind of doing something that was a little more like melancholy and maybe kind of a little more like indie rock or something, for kind of lack of a better word.
My critical statement about it then, but the difference between when I listen to the Jill and then listen to that and listen to the Gentleman Rogues is, whether it was intentional or not, the songs from the Fall Collection aren't as catchy. Like, I didn't catch on to anything really. What I was getting at is, I feel like, whether you realize or not, you, through your progression of music, took that really poppy band, sort of combined it with this a little bit more experimental, and came up with this, like, the sweet spot band, like the, you know, it's not too cold, not too hot soup, you know, like you combined your experiences into the Gentleman Rogue. Would you buy into that at all?
I would buy into that. I never have really thought about that. There was, but that makes sense to me. There was, between Jill and the Fall Collection, there was college. So, I mean, that was 4 or 5 years in between those bands. And so I didn't, like I said, I really played drums mostly during that time, and I played guitar some, but not that much. So I'm a big, big music nerd, and I grew up on punk music. I have an older showed me the Sex Pistols when I was in like fifth grade. And so I've listened to punk rock since I was probably 11 years old or something. And I just got lucky. You know, I had an older brother that turned me on to all that stuff. And then I, for whatever reason, got bit by that punk bug. And then I just, my nature is to be kind of completist with, you know, collecting records and blah, blah, blah. And so I just dove into it. And I was always looking for new bands. And if, you know, I would find the Velvet Underground, and then I would go on to Lou Reed's stuff. And then I would learn about the Jesus and Mary Chain because of the Velvet Underground. And I was just always following stuff, and I was always wanting to hear new things. And so probably what happened with Jill, because Jill, I'm analyzing this now because of your question, but yes, this makes sense to me. When we did Jill, that was the band that I said that was the first band I ever did. That was the first time I ever wrote songs. And so we were, most people's first band is a very heavy influence on the things that you listen to.
Right, right, right.
And so for us, it was Screeching Weasel, Green Day, The Descendants. Seconds probably was a big influence, like maybe like the New Wind album.
Danny cut out for a second, so you might not have gotten that. He was talking about the 7 Seconds album, New Wind, which came out in 1986.
Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control.
And welcome to the middle of the interview, where now we get to present to you our one and only advertiser. And this is Siren Records in McHenry, Illinois. I really love this place. My friend, the Linquists that run the record store, are a pretty great married couple. They're very passionate about their record store. It's a great place to visit. It's very homey, and they have a great selection of contemporary and classic music and rock and metal and a bunch of different passion projects. They're really into the Lillingtons and Teenage Bottle Rocket, so a lot of interesting posters and records from that gang. They also deal with cassettes, and they will buy old records and cassettes from you. And if you go into the back room, you see that they have an amazing selection of old and new stereos, record players, amplifiers, speakers. It's a pretty fascinating place, and they do a lot of repairs on things like that too. Got a staff that works there in this little cubby hole with all these amazing tools. Anyway, you can visit their website at www.sirenrecordsmchenry.com. You have to put the McHenry in there, McHenry. So once again, that's SirenRecordsMchenry.com.
Back to Danny and me.
Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control. Johnny's got a problem and he's out of control.
All that stuff was coming into to us, and because I wasn't by any means an accomplished songwriter, I was on some level, copying my heroes, you know, quote unquote. Even in Jill, like, we were listening to different types of music and getting into other things, even though we were playing like pop punk. And then I guess in that period between Jill and the Fall Collection, I was listening to a lot more kind of, you know, I got really into like Modest Mouse and their early stuff and early Built to Spill. And I always liked a lot of that kind of indie rock stuff from the Pacific Northwest, K Records and all that stuff. And so I probably think some of that creeped in. to like what I wanted to do musically. And that's probably why the Fall Collection was still coming from an energetic kind of punky place, but probably had more of a indie rock experimentalness quality to it. I'm guessing. That makes sense to me.
Yeah, no, I mean, just listening to it today, I really do feel like, and it's, I don't know, as we get older, as I get older, it's nice to see people progressing and it actually getting better. Like, I honestly yeah. say that you learned some lessons from Fall Collection and incorporated them into Gentleman Rogue and brought it to a more powerful place and a little bit more melodic, which I dig.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. I feel good about Gentleman Rogues. Like, I know what you mean. And especially with this new, we're recording a new record as we speak, like we're almost done with it. And it's going to be even more calling back to my youth, I guess, because I feel like that song, Do the Resurrection and Francie, those songs were like things I would have written when I was 19 or 20, if I would have been better at writing songs, you know what I mean? They're very poppy and very like, kind of more punky and power poppy. And a lot of the stuff on our brand new record we're finishing is more kind of in that vein. Whereas maybe some of the other Gentleman Rogue stuff is catchy, but it's still kind of like indie rockish and power poppy kind of in the middle somewhere, you know?
What is the, this is not a kind of a departure, but not, we'll see. What is your relationship with the covers you do? Do you like, here, I'll tell my story and then you tell your reasons.
Okay.
But like, through Screeching Weasel, I never really would consider myself a guitarist and I didn't really do covers. I mean, Ben would bring in a Ramone song or something, but I didn't learn through doing other people's music, which I thought was in some ways a fault, some ways a cool thing because I just learned from nothing. So I learned from my own unique way of playing. And then even in Blackouts, I went back and said, I feel like I miss something, like I'm missing a tool in my box of understanding how other people write songs. And that really changed how I write. So I'm just curious as to your relationship. You seem to always, there's not a lot of releases, but you seem to have a relationship with cover songs that you sprinkle into your recordings.
Yeah.
And since you don't have a lot, it makes a mark. Since your catalog isn't so huge for the band, it those covers actually make an impression. So I'm just curious as to your relationship to them.
Yeah, we could probably combine them and make like an EP of just cover songs because there's probably about five of them. But I think when I started learning how to play guitar, I learned by ear. To this day, I don't really know how to read music. I can do like every good deserves, but you know, and I can figure out notes on a sheet of music, but I could never follow along to it. I'm just like, I don't get
the same
it.
Way,
so. Math to me. And my brain doesn't like math. So I taught myself how to play guitar by listening to records and just learned by ear. And so I think when I was teaching myself how to guitar, I was like learning Ramone songs, learning Clash songs, just stuff that was like fairly easy and just learned it by ear. And I think I've always sort of done that through and always had kind of relationships through music relationships with cover songs, because that's sort of what taught me how to play to some degree. Mm-hmm. Now as an adult, I think that they're just fun to do. I think that what the one thing that we kind of have a rule for though, is that we never really will cover a song like as it goes, like as it's written. We will pick something that we think would be cool, and then we try to do like our own kind of interpretation of it. So like, for example, we did a Erasure cover on our History So Repeating EP. And that's,
I'm going to ask a question about that just so you know, but go ahead.
Oh yeah. I might answer it right here, but what we did with that, the idea with that was like, that's a great song. It's just a great song. So I guess that's the first rule is like, what's a really great song? So that's a really awesome song. And the idea for that was like, let's just make it like Billy Bragg. And I was just going to play it on a little dirty guitar, and it just be a guitar and a vocal. And that was the idea for the Erasure cover, was to try to approach it like a Billy Bragg song. And when we recorded it in the studio, we listened back and it needs more. It's like, it's too sparse. So then we started adding like floor toms, and we added like four of us all in a room banging on floor toms. I think a total of like five or six floor toms. And then I think we added a little piano and we kind of added a little bit to it. But, you know, that original song is like this kind of electro dance kind of pop hit. And we sort of tried to make this kind of melancholy stripped down version of it. And I think it turned out really neat with that Super Drag Lemonhead song that we kind of merged together. That was, it was like, I just one day had this realization that Rudderless by the Lemonheads and Destination Ursa Major by Super Drag and When You Sleep by My Bloody Valentine, they all shared this ascending chord progression. And it was like almost in the same key, the same rhythm. And I just, it dawned on me. And I just started playing around with like, how could you merge those things together? And it just sort of really kind of serendipitously worked out where it all fit together like a puzzle piece, like perfectly. And it sounds to me, when I hear that song we did, we called it Bloody Rudderless and Ursa Major. We took all the song titles and meshed them together too. It sounds like that's the way the song was written. I think if you played it for someone who didn't know those songs, they would think it was an original song. But for people who do know what those songs are, people are usually very like, what the fuck? You know, like, this is so crazy. It's so cool how it all just, like, it fits together, yeah. You know? And so that, I guess the I'm being very long-winded answering this question, but we just, like, we always want to do a cover song for, like, a B-side. I don't know why when we do a single, we always want the B-side to be a cover. I think, like, bands like Oasis do that, and we just kind of like, you know, when bands do cover songs and we like doing them, they're just fun. So we really never play them live. We'll just kind of learn them and do our thing with them. And then we record them and we pretty much are done with it after that.
Do you think, whether you know it or not, it's affecting the stuff you write afterwards? Like, is it tangibly affecting how you write as a person? Or do you purposely pick something that is already in your comfort zone of, you know, of covering?
Definitely not picking things in our comfort zone, because no band I've ever been in sounds anything remotely close to Erasure. but I love that song. You know, my kid in junior high, my sister, she had a bedroom that was next door to mine, and she would listen to Erasure and Foreigner like every morning when she'd get ready for school. Yeah. She'd be doing her hair dryer, blasting those two bands, and I'd be waking up in the morning hearing that through the wall. And I, you know, I was like into punk rock and stuff. So I was like, could never admit to liking a Erasure song, but I secretly really liked a lot of those Erasure songs. And now I'm openly admitting that I love that band, but you know, that's just a song I've always liked. I was introduced to it in a kind of a funny way through my sister's bedroom wall. And it's just a song I've always thought about would be a cool song to cover. And, you know, 25 years later, we did. Yeah.
I was listening to it today, Danny, and it's a good cover. I still like the original more. That's often usually the case. But yeah, huge fan of Vince Clark. I mean, all the way from Depeche Mode to Erasure to Yaz. Like even a Blackout's cover to Only You song, which I think is perfection. But what I'd say, and I liked you saying that you did sort of a folky feel to it, because what I think you revealed in that song that I think is amazing is you actually helped reveal how good Vince Clark is of a catchy writer. Like, you even made it, I think, I don't even know if you even know this, but you made it more palpable to me that it's a really well done, like, structured song, like something it buried under the synthesizer and all that, which I do like. It's great to dance to too. I love dancing, but it loses that folky thing you're saying of like realizing it's actually a well-constructed song.
Yeah. I mean, you hear people say there's the rules to like songs is, you know, if you say there are rules is like, you know, it's a good song if you can just play it on an acoustic guitar and sing it. If it's still really good, then, you know, you've written a good song. You could take away all the keyboards and electric guitars and drums and blah, blah, blah. And if you strip it down to just an acoustic and a voice and it's still awesome, then you killed it. That's a good example of maybe us maybe not realizing that's what we were doing, but like, you know, and I think to your point, you know, we did strip that song down on purpose, but it does reveal how great of a song it is.
Yeah.
Not that we did that, but you know what
I
mean?
No, like, that's why it was a hard thing to say, because I didn't want to downplay the work you did, but I also want to highlight that I like that song beyond covering it.
But yeah, you're right though. I mean, essentially that theory of stripping a song down and it's still good. I mean, that's kind of maybe an example of how we maybe inadvertently did that, but yeah, I mean, it's just a good song. And I think that's kind of the point, is like, we're just always looking for like, what's a good song? What's well-written? I think as I've gotten older, that's stuff that I think about a lot more, is like this construction of a song and not so much of like, you know, I don't want to use too many chords or, you know, I don't know. I just try not to overthink stuff. And I try to just focus on like, how is this going to be constructed well and maybe clever? Yeah. You know, I feel like one thing that Gentleman Rogues always does is we have a moment in a song that like only happens once for like a few seconds. It's usually like some kind of transition into something, and then it never happens again. So there's like this little piece in almost every song that's like, it only happens this one little time and you never hear that again. Yeah. We do that a lot.
I really like that, Danny, because my band, Even in Blackouts, I had a song called Consequences where I wanted to write a song that never returned. Like I wanted it to feel like it was a moving object through space, but still feel melodic, but it never actually ever returns to parts that it had created along its path. So,
A
goal for me, and I think you might dig this sort of stuff too, is that you like playing with odd elements, but ultimately you don't want people to really, it's weird to say it, but you don't want people to appreciate on that level. You want them just to get into the song. And that's always the interesting, hard thing for me, is to make something different, but also making it a same enough for people to be able to get into it. Does that make sense?
You know? Yeah, no, it does. It makes perfect sense. That's something that I think that we don't consciously construct songs in that way, because I don't know if I would know how to do that, but I do think that our songs are more complicated than they sound, and I think we are aware of that. So if we ever have like I hope I'm making sense, but like anytime we've ever had like a bass player that come in, and if we've like got a new bass player, a very common thing to happen in our band is when people learn the songs that they're like, these songs are way harder than they seem like they would be. And so I think, to your point, it's like the song is maybe complicated, and maybe the arrangement is kind of tricky, or maybe it's sort of technically kind of difficult to play at times, but it never sounds like that, you know? And I think that's to your average listener, they wouldn't listen to the song and go, this is a weird arrangement, or, oh, that's weird. The song starts with the bridge. Why does it do that? You know, but you just hear it the way they're put together. It just sounds like a pop song.
Yeah.
You know? So it doesn't sound as complicated as it actually is.
Yeah, I think I really became keyed into that element when I went during Weasel, and then we went to the West Coast, and that was when like the Soundgarden, that sort of movement was happening. But there was a lot of math rock bands that were like, I was like, what am I listening to? You know, people really got into it, but I didn't, because I like melody. And I was like, well, how can I combine all that? And do something where someone can actually get into it and groove. So it's always been like a challenge of mine to try to merge that, like that progressive feel, but make it really, you know, folksy, like, or very pop driven.
When we started Gentleman Rogues, there was a bunch of bands from the UK in the like the early 2000s, like early mid 2000s. This band called the Future Heads. I don't know if you know who those guys are. Really, really badass. A band called the Maccabees. There's a band called Dutch Uncles, Field Music. There's all these bands from the UK that were doing kind of post-punky guitar music that was like really technical, but like very, very melodic at the same time. Franz Ferdinand was kind of a band in that got really popular, but it was like stuff kind of in that vein that was like influenced by Gang of Four and Wire and stuff like that. And so like, if you haven't heard the Future Heads, you should check out like their first like self-titled album. All their records are great, but that one is maybe a great starting point. It's like, like Gang of Four with like Adam and the Ants vocals, you know, like four part barbershop, almost harmonies. But these just crazy guitar, like, what the fuck are you playing? It's like, it's so rad. Yeah. It's really, really cool.
I often bring up this band and, it doesn't get the reaction that maybe it was a time, a period where it meant more to me, and it didn't, and it was in the mainstream for short, and then it went away. But I feel, and this comes around to you, because there's something about your style that reminds me of David Lorre from Cracker, who is in.
Oh, was it? That is so weird.
Camper Van Beethoven is the band that I knew him from. And I don't think he ever gets credit for being like one of the first in pop music to be singing, not really to the rhyme, but like to humor. And you know what I'm trying to get? Like it isn't even talk singing, but it seems like you touch on it a little bit, like this breaking the barrier of what it is to write a poetry of a song. And it reminds me of Cracker, because he would just... This line doesn't rhyme with anything or something, like making it meta in a way. You're making yourself aware of the writing of the song. I don't know. There's something about your style that reminded me of, because I think in an interview you actually talked about Sugar. Whenever I think about Sugar, I always think of Cracker too, because they came out around the same time.
Oh I love Bob Mould and I love Husker Du, but I feel like I'm like one of those people that is sacrilegious and saying like I kind of like Sugar better than Husker Du. You're not supposed to say that, maybe, but that I personally do. We just got to play a couple of shows with Bob Mould in this past October.
Oh, and it was like, that's great.
You know, I started listening to Husker Du when I was in like eighth grade or ninth grade or something, junior high. And just being like, we got on those shows. It was like, I was literally got the email. Like, do you guys want to play with Bob Mould in Dallas and Austin on these two dates? And I my hands like started shaking. I was literally like, I was like, what? Oh my God. And it was really cool. We got to, you know, chat with him a little bit. It was COVID, so we had to keep it.
He was on one of those talk shows last year and I was a little worried. I'm like, Bob Mould, new stuff. Is this going to, and it was powerful. Like I was really impressed with how strong it was. Like after so many years of creating music, he still got that, I don't know, punk feel to him.
He's become more that now, you know, like there was that, he had that middle period with like Black Sheets of Rain and Work and those albums that were more like acoustic.
Yeah, and I like all that stuff too. Yeah, I like his.
Me too. But it's like the older he gets, the more he's like raging, you know? He's like, and live, they slay. You know, it's John Worster from Superchunk, who's a killer drummer, and Jason Narduzzi, who toured, and he has split single, and you know, it's like that, they're just a power, like in the true sense of the word. You know,
this is something I often ask a bunch of different, because I see for myself, like a couple of friends that are so into knowing about music, knowing about theory, that it's hard for them to write because they're constantly going, oh, this has been done already, I can't do it, and then they end up writing stuff that isn't very good. So there's a balance in me that's always worried of being too much of a music fan, because I don't want to stop myself from being creative. But at the same time, you want to know what's out there to grow. Do you ever have like a conflict of feeling like your stuff isn't original to you enough, or does that just not matter to you? I mean,
it doesn't matter to me. I don't, if anything, a lot of the newer stuff that Gentleman Rogues has been doing is, but I've been very, very consciously saying, don't overthink this, because I have I admittedly have a bad problem with like getting in my own head about stuff. And I do that with lyrics really bad. Going back to like, I'm scared I'm going to ruin this song that I really like, and I'm going to put really terrible lyrics on it, and the whole song's going to be fucked. And so therefore I procrastinate for months on it. I've gotten really good in the last year or so with being like, that's good enough. I'm not going to think about this anymore. This sounds cool. I'm going to leave it alone. And I'm finding that I'm becoming more prolific writing than I've ever been, which is weird. In like the 30 years I've been playing music, I've written a lot more songs in the last year or two than I have my whole life. You know, it's weird. So Gentleman Rogues is about to have some more releases, but I've just gotten in a mindset of like, I'm not going to overthink this so much, and I'm going to just be happy with what it is. But I also think, at risk of sounding arrogant, I've just gotten better, you know, like I've gotten better at writing songs, and I've just improved as a musician and as a songwriter. And then on top of that, I'm not getting in my own head about it. I'm being very mindful of that. So it seems to be working, to where like, hey, we're cranking out a bunch of songs and guess what? They're really cool. You know, like we're all really happy with them. And they're kind of getting back to, like I said earlier, they're kind of getting back to my youth a bit more, where I feel like I'm writing more like kind of punky, simpler kind of punky songs. And, yeah. and it's been a lot of fun.
Do you spend as much time, Danny, being as critical about you as a singer, or do you, or does that just sort of float more and go under the radar of your criticalness?
No, I'm critical of it, but I don't know how I feel about my singing. I don't think I'm a great singer, but I don't think I'm like a shitty singer. Mm-hmm. I'm not trained in it at all, and I don't ever warm up, which I probably should, but I just, I like, but I don't think I'm super good at it. But I'm not shitty at it.
Right. But I mean, but you've...
That's my thoughts on singing.
Yeah. But at least in all of your recorded records, you are the singer. So there must be some...
Yeah.
A large amount of commitment to yourself as to be the singer of the band. Like something you can do that someone you could hand the songs couldn't do, or you don't want them to do.
I think this maybe is the more appropriate use of a double-edged sword, where I like being the singer and I like doing it. But the sort of responsibility that comes with it, I don't really like. Mm. Like, I don't like writing lyrics, and I don't always like having to be the one to get up and be the voice. But in the end, I like it. And I think I used to like it a lot more than I do now, but I still enjoy it enough that I'm still doing it. I sound like I'm being a real pissy about being the singer, but I like it. I mean, if I didn't like doing it, I wouldn't do
yeah,
it.
Yeah, no. Thanks for your honesty. I think one of the things I try to do on the program is... I think when you get to those real things, they don't sound as pithy or as, it just seems relatable. I mean, if any singer would be honest about, they like the attention, but you know, they might not always like all the other stuff around it. But I was just curious.
Yeah. I want to talk about something back, what you said earlier for a minute, because you said that there was something about us that, or about me lyrically or something that was like David Lowery.
Yeah.
Heard that before. I wanted to chime in when we were talking about that earlier, and it got away, but I've heard that before. And the funny thing is I've heard one Cracker song and I've heard one Camper Van Beethoven song. That's all I know of him. But when we toured in the UK twice, one of the times we were over there, I had two different people at two different shows be like, you guys are really good. I'm not going to fake the accent. Yeah. I'm terrible at that. but there's like, you know, you guys are great. You guys remind me of, you sound like David Lowery, or like, do you know Cracker? And I'm like, I know who they are. And he's like, yeah, you sound like that guy. You remind me of that guy. And I'm like, and I was like, oh, that's weird. I would have never, like, I don't, when you said that, I was like, what the hell? Like, cause I don't understand it at all. I don't know enough about him and his music to know what the similarities
are.
Yeah,
I think it's probably physically and also in the sound of, I think the tenor of your voice is a little similar. And also he's kind of dorky in a good way. So cool dorky, which you sort of have that cool dork thing going to.
All right, sweet. At least it's not dork, right?
No, I wouldn't be talking to you if it was dork.
when will I ever be cool? That's the thing.
I don't shoot that high. I mean, just
jeez.
Is there anything you want to say that's current about the, this will probably be out within a month. So what do we need to know about the band and what you're doing that to help sell you, Danny?
This is the plug.
Yeah, this is the plug.
Yeah. Okay. The plug moment. So, so we just put out a single called Francie that's on Snappy Little Numbers. That just came out like 3 weeks ago, maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago. And we have a 12-inch coming out called A History of Fatalism, which is two EPs that we put out a few years ago that are getting pressed to vinyl for the first time. It's going to be one EP on each side. It's going to be on red transparent vinyl and opaque yellow. So you have two color options. Mm-hmm. And then we're just finishing a brand new record that is a 10 song album. We've got to do vocals on a few more songs and then we mix it and it's done. And that, who knows, but that's got a lot of the sort of stuff we talked about earlier, which is like kind of more of like punky driven songs, a little more simple, a little more catchy and like hooky. So songs like Francie and Do the Resurrection, those singles we put out in the last year or so, like stuff more in that vein. We're going to have essentially two full-length records come out within the next, you know, the equivalent of one for this one that'll come out this summer, probably in July. And then the brand new one will come out, you know, next year, like maybe late 2022 or early 23, whenever it gets released. And then, yeah, we're just going to start playing shows. We just found out we're going to get to open for one of my all-time favorite bands, Superchunk, on May 27th here in Austin. And that's going to be awesome. And then we're just going to start trying to play more. It seems like COVID is finally kind of going away, or at least getting sort of watered down enough that it's getting safer to kind of live a somewhat normal life. So hoping to like get out and start playing more and getting out of Austin and touring and just being like in a band the way you're supposed to be in a band.
Well, Danny, I'm actually pretty proud that I'm pretty proud we went almost an hour and a half and we didn't have to talk about the Austin scene.
Yeah, don't even get me started on that. I don't want to talk about it.
When I started talking to you, I was like, oh, I'm not even going to really have to want to go there, because you've actually touched on it in a couple of other interviews. So I'll probably like make links to that. So if people are interested in Danny's view on Austin, Texas and the South by Southwest and what's going on there now, I'll put links to other interviews.
Yeah. Well, hey man, I really appreciate you doing this with me. Yeah. And I really appreciate you being like easy to talk to. And if I nerd for a second, you know, going back to Jill, like we were the biggest Screech and Weasel nerds and we like loved you guys and the big influence on our band. So when Chris hit me up and was like, you want to do an interview with Jughead? I was like, oh, am I going to be starstruck? Am I going to be like weird? but I think I'm too old to be starstruck at this point. And you are just like a cool dude to talk to. So I really appreciate you making this easy.
Oh, cool.
Hopefully I made it easy for you.
Yeah,
too.
Yeah. No, I approached Chris and asked for like a handful of different bands, and you're the only one I selected from that list because I really liked your.
Oh, song, sweet! So. Awesome, man. Thank you.
All right, Danny.
Nice to meet you. All right, John. Do you go by John, or do you only like to be called Jughead?
I go by John, but I mean, people call me Jughead all the time. It doesn't matter.
Yeah. All right. Well, nice to meet you, John. Thanks for making it fun.
Bye bye.
You make my reveries run riot. I can't break you out of my mind. What could have been keeps playing with my heart. Let out a sigh till the next time that you and I collide. What could have been keeps playing with my heart. What could have been keeps playing with my heart. What could have been keeps playing with my heart.
If you have just made it this far, you just got done listening to Francie, the new release in 2022 by Gentlemen Rogues. Thanks again for listening, and as I stated in the beginning, please share this podcast with others. And go to www.jugheadsbasementpodcast.com and become a patron and help out on a grander scale if you're able to. If not, just write a review or give us a star count of 4 or 5. That would be very nice. Upcoming, I have one scheduled, but I also have a lot of interesting, cool news coming up in the near future. But right now, I'll just say that we have Trevor from the band Pelican, and also his newer band called RLYR. Very interesting instrumental punk, jazz, metal, fusion type band that is pretty exciting. So stay tuned.